Yeah, I said, there's all these stoppages. He said, no, you got to learn them. No, he said, you got to be able to put it back together within 3 minutes. Well, I know which end is the poison end of a gun, and I know where the trigger is. I know where the everything else is, and the, just the look of them, you know where they go. So I, he said, left it there. He said, I'll put it back together and show you again, put it all back together. And then he tore it apart again. He said, no. There, you gotta practice this. So he said, I'll leave you alone, let you work on it. So I worked on it there for, well, I guess, 10, 12 hours, fooling around with it. Sometimes I'd get a part that, a small little part that didn't want to fit or something. But anyway, I got so I put it together in less than 3 minutes. He said, great. He said, great, now you got two of them up there. He said, you won't be the only one up there. He said, there's an engineer is going to be there. He said, if you need him, he said, the engineer will be... The machine gun had round things on top where it had 48 rounds in it. And you just push the button, put the one off, and pop another one on if it run empty, you know, that sort of thing. And as I learned all those things, and everything went fine, but all the time I'm squawking, I said, when we pull out, from Victoria, from Vancouver, come out around Victoria and out in Wanda Fuca Strait, and we went up the coast. Well, I found out then why they needed me. Because as a small boy, I was only, seven, 8, 9 years old. My mother used to, see, there was no roads from here to Nitnat or Port Renfrew. You had to go by CPR boat. And she put a necklace around my... This is the way they treated boys that were picked out to be hereditary chiefs. They had this. We weren't taught the same as the average little boy running around. We were looked at real hard and made sure we did everything right. And she'd send me up there. She put a string around my neck with a tag on it. To one of the, I guess, people that run the darn boat, and he'd look at it and, oh yeah, you get off at Nitnat, or you get off at, yeah. But then they'd send canoes out, and we'd take the mail, they'd take the mail and me into the canoe and way ashore. Well, then they'd train us to land canoes in heavy surf, and I mean, real heavy surf. They had a whole bunch of us boys in there, and that's what we learned. And then they sent me to Nitnat for river running and more hazardous experiences, like at the Nitnat bar was always breaking. Almost always breaking swells in the bar. They'd make us run in there. And I had a pal there, his name was Joe Edgar. He's passed away now. He was a real friend of mine, and we did that. We both took a training the same. We stuck together when we were doing it. Went up the river, learned how to pole up a river and how to set a gill net up there and how to do this, how to gaff them and all this sort of thing. About everything was about the ocean and all inlets and how to run through shallow water and how to just look at a piece of water and tell you how deep it is and all kinds of things. But they knew that, and when we got there, you see, Jordan River, from Jordan River to Port Renfrew, was a telephone line in World War One, I guess, or maybe shortly after, I'm not sure. But by now, this is World War Two, and the trees had been falling across the line the full length. It was just a shambles. That line was just a shambles, so they had to renew it because the Japs were ready to invade the island here, and they had to have communication from all up and down the island. Guess who was supposed to land all these people? I guess it was a corps of engineers, I'm not sure, that they made me a dory. Oh, it was around 18 feet, and it had two bulkheads, and you couldn't sink it. You could fill one bulkhead, and the boat would still float. And it had two sets of oars in it, and they'd say, take these 25 men into that beach there. I'd run them in there, and you have to choose a wave to go in on, the proper one. God help your soul if you took the wrong one. But anyway, we did all that, and all that maintenance during the day, and at night we had to go and search for submarines. So we were going steady all the time, just doing nothing but traveling around as fast as we could go. And I used to say to the commanding officer, you know, all we are is a bunch of clay pigeons. I said, decoys is what we are. I said, and if we're out there just decoying submarines, as far as I can see, trying to get them to show themselves so they could send a torpedo right through us, and you wouldn't be able to find a piece as big as a matchstick after one of those things went off in our hull. He said, no, 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 no. He said, they won't do that. He said, they come all the way from Japan already. He said, they probably sunk a couple of merchant boats, he said, and they're low on torpedoes, and he said, they have to go home. He said, and when they go home, they're going to need torpedoes. He said, they're not going to use them on you. And he said, besides, one of those torpedoes is worth a lot of the kind of boats you're in. He said, there's way more than what you're worth. So I thought, thanks a lot. And he said, now, he said, you, and anyway, he said, you got an out here. I said, oh yeah. He said, if you see a submarine laying up against the things charging their batteries, he said, all you have to do is, he said, what they're going to do to you, they're not going to torpedo you. He said, what they're going to do is they're going to use a deck gun on you. I said, oh, thanks a lot, thanks a lot. He said, now it's up to you. And he poked his finger toward my forehead. He said, up to you. He said, keep them from using that gun. I said, well, when you see a submarine, don't usually see anybody running around the deck. He said, no. He said, they got a conning tower there, and when they open that lid, he said, they're going to come out of there and go to the front where the gun is. He says, now that's up to you. He said, you got to keep them in that hole. He said, keep them from opening that thing. He said, when you sight one, you got to go full speed straight at it. He said, and get as close as you can so you can do the shooting. Oh, I thought, oh, Jesus. So that's what happened. But, we had a lot of experiences, and like I say, in day and night, and out there in Christmas, New Year's, when the storm was blowing, and one day our engine started to limp, so we said, well, we got to come in for a refit. So, and everything was done in code, so we said, they said, okay, we'll get the ways ready for you to come in. So we right into Vancouver, and all the time I'm writing letters to my wife here where we're going to be, and might have a minute or two together, you know. But she kind of followed wherever on this island I was. She was going to get closer to me. Anyway, we got going in there for refit. And when we got fixed up and left, after my squawking about all the time, we're clay pigeons, and we were called the Gumboot Navy because we were all fishermen. And he sent this motorcycle down there again. The guy got out and he come to the at this time, I changed the captains. Harry Kemp come back, I guess, there was an army camp here in Sioux. He come back to this army camp, and Wally Layton from a reserve just this side of Alaska. He was a long time pal of mine, and he was captain. So when we left Vancouver to come out, they gave us a envelope again, and it says, do not open until you're, I think it was 30 miles off Estevan Point. That's the point that the Japs used a deck gun on. They shelled at Estevan Point. And so it said, when you're, and it says, position first, and this code word for position. Wally and I were studying it, and sighting second, but position always first. Never a word on the radio without position first. So, and the radio they put in the boat was a huge thing. It, you could listen to people in Mexico and everywhere else all yakking. But like I say, we had all code. And it says when you get, I think it was 30 or 40 miles, something like that, off Estevan Point, report sighting. So here we are. I'm steering away, Wally sitting there, and we're, I think, just, it was a real nice day, and we were going along pretty good, no heavy sea or anything.
Well, it was about
an half an hour before it was getting daylight, but it was a haze, and you couldn't see too far, and we were in the wheelhouse and traveling along, and the cook come running up and he said, I just was out on the deck. He said, did you hear anything? And we said, no, I don't hear anything. I said, we hear our engine running. He said, oh, he said, there's a funny noise out there. So I thought, well, we'll go out and listen. So we went out and listened. We could hear this going along, and I thought, and that's after reported our position and sighting. And it was like coming from but about southeast. And then we went to the stern, and there was some coming from the noise coming from the stern. It was coming from all the way around us. And and I looked into when the sun come up. The sun was almost up then on the horizon, when the sun peaked up over the horizon. There was and I noticed something flash in the water. What the heck would that be? Well, a submarine. So, but it wasn't. I don't know. Was a tiny little airplane anyway, with only one guy in it, and that thing was going, and it looked like it was only 10 feet above the water. I thought, my, that's something. And Wally and I were staring at the thing, and it come along and went right past our mast. I thought, wow, that's something else. Looked over this way, and there's a 15 or 20 more coming. And they're coming from this, coming from that way, coming from that way, coming from all different directions. The air was it seemed to me like a seething, teeming mass of airplanes. And then you could hear this, and almost out of sight, you could see these great big bombers, Catalinas the other one. There was two types. There were the types like look like boats, but they didn't have pontoons. They were just the hull was the boat, and that's the way they were. But they were big. Them big. I don't think they had four engines. I think those big bombers. They were so high you couldn't. And they came from every airport there was. There was big bombers. They had. They could land with their hull, and they had wheels also. They could crawl up onto the. And they came from Euclid. There was a big base in Euclid, where those Catalinas and I forget the name of the other one. Anyway, we lost one of them, but. Then that made us feel better, eh? We knew that, and I guess the Japs must have been, I'll swear, they must have been watching that performance, because it wasn't short, it wasn't very long after that, that they just, of course, time went by and by and by, and anyway, all of a sudden the Japs just picked up and left. Poof. And then we found out that the United States was in it also, and they were sending I don't know how many hundreds of men over onto that island that were going to take it over. But when they got there, the Jap tracks from where they were running away were still smoking. And when they left, they bombed Dutch Harbor, but they didn't bomb it to hit the house. They dropped their bombs in between the houses. How I knew that was is, oh, this is 15 years later. I'm captain of a big halibut boat, the Joan W-2. She carried 80,000 pounds, and I took me and the crew of seven. Went into the Bering Sea to fish halibut, and we were having good trips. But I only went once, because on the way home I had a heck of a time. Everything in the boat burned out except my wristwatch and the compass, and that's all I had to come home with. And I put about six sleepless nights in there coming home. But anyway, all of those things, and I spent 1,090 days outside of Canada on the Pacific Ocean, and that is during the war. Eh? This what I was saying. But when I went in there with the Joan W-2 to buy something out of the store. I was walking up toward the store, and there come an old man coming down toward me, and I passed a bunch of these great big holes in among the houses, the big holes, and the houses were quite a distance apart, and I said to that old man, I said, "No, what make all those holes? What are you guys digging for gold here?" He said, "No, no, no, they're bomb holes." I said, "Oh yeah, well." He said, I got up one morning, he said, right out of the sun. He said, I heard this noise, I looked up, and here comes the airplanes right out of the sun. And they were dropping bombs in between the houses, not to hit them. Why, I'll never know. I guess I don't think anybody will ever know. But they never hit a house. And I always say it's just their way of saying, nee, 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 nee. We were here, you know, and this is what we could have done, you know. But I guess they found out. You see, it wasn't only us. It was we were called the Water Transport. We were a branch of the Royal Canadian Army Service Corps, and they say that wasn't a fighting outfit. I don't know anything about it anyway, but that's what our outfit was. But it was called Water Transport. It wasn't called Submarine Hunters or anything. It hadn't. I guess they kept that all quiet. I don't know. But anyway, there was us and the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force all had just about the same amount of boats all there. The Air Force took most of the inside waters and stuff like that. They had boats like hospital boats and those fast 50 mile an hour boats, and I guess those guys seen the writing on the wall that to send any of their equipment in there would be absolutely fatal. And you know, with all that air power, well, I guess the air power was coming from the coast of Washington and parts of Oregon, I guess, and of course Ucluelet, Tofino, and the air base in Comox, is it? And they were coming from everywhere, just as that demonstration. And I guess those chaps. And oh, and not only that, we had our counterpart was loggers. They took most of the loggers, the ones that were, I guess, young enough and made the grade, and made guerrilla fighters out of them. They issued them 30-30 carbine rifles with hard-nosed bullets. And my pal that lived here in Souk, he was a crack shot too. And he got one of them things, and they trained him in
the Rangers.
South Vancouver Island. They call it now South Vancouver Island Ranger Gun Club. But it was... there was those loggers' headquarters where they learned their fighting ways, I guess. They were all along the coast here. And like I say, I don't know how many of them were there, but I know there was a few from here. And believe me, they were all good hunters. And I guess... Jap got in among them, he wouldn't last too long. But that's how everything went. It was quite a thing. And like I say, that 1090 days I spent out there, and that's what they base all my pension and my whatever I get is all based on that 1090 days outside of Canada and the Pacific campaign. So North Pacific campaign it was, I guess. And that's where our name Gumboot Navy came from. Because like, well, I never seen so many fishermen in one place. Even the Air Force had them. The Navy had them because of their knowledge of what we figure is if we seen a submarine in the inlets charging their batteries, we knew which way to go so they couldn't follow us. I mean, we'd duck around an island and get in shallow water, and they couldn't follow. And we knew where all the shallow water was. We knew where everything, every speck of these inlets we knew, because we all fished there. And that's why they called it Gumboot Navy. But anyway, I hope this would help you, and say the children to come, they need to know what their grandpas, I guess, have been doing. So I know I got quite a few grandchildren, and I'm not the only one. There's been hundreds doing the same thing as I've been doing, and they all got, I imagine, I hope they all have grandchildren, because we looked after one another like twins, you know. We worked that way. We did everything not for totally for me. We did it for our pals too. And all the time we were there, we only lost one bomber, and it blew up right in Euclid Harbor. It was coming in for a landing one day, and the minute the harbor was mirror smooth, and the minute the bomber hit the water, it blew up. The whole thing just exploded like one big bomb, and there was nothing you could pick up but parts here and there everywhere. We were right off Euclid, about 20 miles out, just happened to be there when the radio come on and said Euclid Harbor immediately, if not sooner. So we just turned around and bombed her straight for the harbor, and that's what we found. One awful mess. But anyway, what I felt sorry for was their wives and children. Euclid Harbor, all those houses on the upper side, the outer side of the harbor, but it's the upper side. It's up on a kind of a like a hill. They had all the houses of the, they called them war houses. They were for the wives and children of the pilots coming in and out, I guess. They moved them in there, and I guess the ladies were all sitting there saying, "Oh, here comes your husband, and that's your husband, and oh, and the next one is your husband. Oh, there comes your husband," I guess, you know, going on. And then one went boom. Nobody knows why or anything like that, but we had to get a bunch of divers and go around, and we had them, took them aboard around, and then we had to carry the remains to Port Alberni. So and I set Port Alberni on fire one time. Not Port Alberni, the Alberni Inlet on fire. One summer's day, we were coming in to pick up a shipment of ammunition for, I forget where it was from, but it was a shipment that we had to pick it up and bring it out to Euclid. So think of the months, but it was in the midsummer. Everything was dry as a bone, and we're coming up the inlet, and Wally and I, you know, he's dead now. He got drowned just off Cape Mudge on the same boat. And we were going along there, and there was an eagle sitting in a tree. Oh, quite a ways away. And I said to him, "You know, I could shoot that eagle, Wally." He said, "No, you can't hit that." I said, "Oh yeah, I've been practicing." They gave me 500 rounds a week to practice. And so anyway, I took the covering off one of the machine guns, loaded it, and I put a tracer bullet in fired it at the eagle just anywhere, not even close to him. And when he seen the tracer go past him, he jumped off the limb and started to fly away from it. And away from it was right at us. So I learned quick. And I thought, well, I took it off. And instead of putting a three-ball ammunition and one tracer, three-ball and one tracer, three-ball and one tracer, so you get this, tell you where you're shooting, I put one ball and one tracer, one ball and one tracer. And, and of course, I'm not going to use that many, so the thing will heat up, you know. So I fire at the eagle, one ball, a tracer, and he'd come toward the boat. And next time he'd start to turn away a little bit, I'd fire ahead of him again. That ball of fire would go past him, and he'd turn away from it. Finally, I had him right here, right up overhead. Then I just went pop, 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 and that was the end of Mr. Eagle. And we had a $10 bet on that. So.
Fireballs flying everywhere.
Oh, but those...